and gentlemen, this is Red Ice Radio. I'm Hendrik Palmgren. Thank you for tuning in today. RedIce.tv is the website. You can, of course, hear the show on a number of different services and channels, such as Stitcher, YouTube, and other places as well. So definitely check out the website for more on how to access our radio shows, videos, and news. Well, today, ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking with Ron Asher. He's the author of In the Jaws of the Dragon, How China is Taking Over New Zealand. And I believe that there's another version of the book as well, which is catered towards the Australian audience. But our guest can tell us more about that. Welcome to the show, Ron. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Hendrik.
So tell us a bit about how you ended up writing the book. I mean, this is a really interesting one. I've always been interested in China and their domination and their economy and their mercantilism. But tell us how it came together.
Well, that's an interesting story itself, actually. I've always been concerned in the last few years that the way they've been moving into our economy and also into our country in such large numbers from mainland China. But I am an historian and a writer of other books, and I have a correspondent whom I have never met, and nor have I ever spoken to him. But for many years, he's been sending me information on different subjects that we've had a mutual interest in. And then he started getting very concerned about China, and he would send me every week or so a pile as big as a telephone book of printouts of news items of how China is taking over not only New Zealand but the whole world. And being very busy with other things, I used to just file these in files and put them aside. And then I looked at a pile one day, and it was about 2 or 3 feet high, and I felt so embarrassed that he did all this work, and I hadn't even got on to doing anything. So the embarrassment caused me to get stuck into it last year, and I went through all these massive files, and I found an awful lot of material that gave a picture of how China has a long-term interest in taking over all the countries of the world to get their economic resources, minerals, oil, and food, especially food, for their people. And they don't do this normally, like, for example, Singapore doesn't have any agricultural land. It's a city-state, but it buys its food from other countries. And so does Japan, also a country that can't feed itself, so it buys on the open market. But China has a different scheme, and China tries to buy huge farms and abattoirs and meatworks and processing plants and vineyards and forests and God knows what in other people's countries, so that they can get from the udder of the cow, the milk will go to the supermarket in China, so the Chinese get all the profit and New Zealanders will get nothing. And our stupid government allows them to buy land in our country. And that is so wrong, because nobody, no New Zealander, no Australian, no Western can buy any freehold land in China, because there is no freehold land in China. The government owns all the land in China and only allows it out on leases up to 70 years. And also, if you ever get offside with the government in China, they can just take your land off you. So therefore, there's no freehold land there, and that's what makes freehold land in other countries so attractive to Chinese businessmen. And this is a very unfair playing field, and I say that that New Zealand, Australia, and other countries should not allow a national of any country to buy freehold land here if we cannot buy freehold land in their country.
Yeah, exactly. Canada is suffering heavily as well. A lot of real estate is going to China right now.
Yes, but the worst is Australia. Some of the farms they bought there, I mean, one man tried to buy 2.5% of the Australian continent. The Kidman Estates, which has been going on so Sydney Kidman about 100 years ago built up a big number of cattle farms in the outback, and they went to sell them, and this Chinese fellow wanted to buy them all, but the government stepped in and prevented it. But there's no limit, and there's no limit to their money. They've got trillions of dollars in bank accounts in China just waiting to be invested in the West, and any farmer in a Western country will unfortunately sell to the highest bidder unless the government prevents that. And our government will never prevent that, because quite frankly, the National Party, which runs New Zealand, is in the pocket of communist China. And I can prove that in the book by mentioning a number of donations that they receive from China.
Let's definitely get into that later and talk more about how all of this is done. But Let's just put one question mark to rest here early on then. I thought that these were individual business owners from China that was just simply buying up land here and there, where they had investment opportunities. They just wanted to get ahead. But you're saying that this is actually the government of China that's behind these businessmen. Tell us more about that.
Almost all the companies in China are owned by either the government of China or the provincial government of Shanghai or one of the other governments of communist China. Over 30,000 companies, and they're all the big companies. But there are a few businessmen who have their own companies, but they are all lackeys of the China government, and many of them have been senior officers in the People's Liberation Army, and then they got concessions which set them on the road to wealth. And then there are others like Li Ka-shing, who is the richest man in Asia, and he is a total lackey of the communist government of China. I'll give you one example of what a lickspittle he is. When Hong Kong was handed over to China in 1997, all the government buildings there passed to the new government of the area, special administrative area of Hong Kong, so that the British had to then build an embassy there, and China wanted an embassy, and they wanted a large embassy of about 9 or 10 stories. And instead of buying land and building it, Li Ka-shing bought a piece of land and built it for them and put a huge multi-story building on it and donated it to the government of China. Now, what sort of lickspittle is that? He buys embassies for the country abroad.
I went past many times the embassy to China that's located in Gothenburg, the second largest city in Sweden. And I remember it always looked like almost like a military building. All the curtains were down, there were surveillance cameras everywhere and everything, and we never saw anyone in there, but I always thought about it as occupied territory. Maybe that was more true than I really realized then.
No, but you're right, because every Chinese embassy abroad has two main functions. One is propaganda and the other is espionage. And they spy mainly on students from China in Western universities, but also on other people as well. And they keep a close eye on these people. And if anybody should join Falun Gong, for example, well, then some bad things are likely to happen to their family back in China. And the indoctrination aspect, the propaganda, is done largely through these Confucius Institutes, which are a direct part of the Chinese government, of the Ministry of Education in Beijing, and it's called Hanban, and they are responsible for setting up these Confucius Institutes all around the world. Now, the first, they put them in universities, allegedly to teach Mandarin, but the other side of it is to teach the culture of China, and basically it's indoctrinating the students into the glories of the civilization of China and its great success economically, but you're not to say a word about Tibet or Taiwanese independence or dissenters or the live organ trade, where they slaughter prisoners to order in prisons so as to get their live organs, which are then put into transplanted into the bodies of senior party members who need them. And the first Confucius Institute in Europe was set up in Stockholm University, but they very soon closed it down because they could see that it was just an instrument of propaganda. And they've had a lot of trouble in America with these, and in Canada especially, also with these Confucius Institutes. But it's got worse, because they also have the Confucius Classroom Program, which is run from these institutes, and that puts these people into secondary schools. And what they do in New Zealand, and presumably in other countries, is they bribe the school. They give the school $10,000, $20,000, whatever, to have the Confucius Classroom Program in the schools. And most schools can't resist the money. And then they come in so many days a week, and they teach not so much Mandarin, they teach a little bit of that, but they teach mostly the glories of the culture of China. And this is an extension of the soft power of the communist government in trying to buy the hearts and minds of Westerners. And it's very dangerous, and also it's very foolish, because Mandarin has got something like 25,000 characters or something, and there are four ways of words can have four different meanings depending on how they're pronounced. And it's not like learning French or German. or English, where there's more or less an exact opposite, in the grammar and that sort of thing. It's all a totally different thing. So that you cannot learn Mandarin, students cannot learn Mandarin any more than saying hello and goodbye and a few things like that. And they must know that. It would take you a lifetime to learn Mandarin properly. And yet they use these, they're right in the secondary schools, glorifying the advantages of China.
Interesting. You know, so I thought, though, that, you know, they have communism, right? So, but you're saying despite communism, they have kind of retained an older national identity, and they back then to their kind of their great periods in their history, right?
Yes, because that serves the purposes of the present government of China. And the Communist Party of China has only one object, and that is not the infliction of Marxism or anything like that on the people. The only object of the Communist Party of China is to stay in power. And they know that if they can tap into this nationalistic pride, which they're doing, and very successfully, then the people are more likely to support the government.
Interesting, because obviously this is a thing that many people have raised, this issue of, you know, wait a minute, they're using capitalism, they're using the free market, they're taking advantage of this in a way that you don't think traditionally a so-called communist country would do. But what do we know more about China in terms of how it operates as a country? I think a lot of Westerners, they just don't know what's going on in the country.
Well, it's very corrupt to start with. It's very, very dirty. That is why the food that they produce is so bad, and why they want food from Western countries, which is why they're buying all these freehold farms in, as I said, in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. The overriding thing is that the Communist Party has to stay in power, end of story. And under this Xi Jinping, this horrible little rat they've got at the moment as their leader, he has imposed a crackdown on dissent that has been unprecedented since Mao's time. And he's got more power than any other leader since Mao, and he's currently got an anti-corruption drive going on, in which he says he's getting rid of corruption, but what he's really doing is just a purge, an old-style purge of opponents of his, and they're put up on false charges of corruption. So China, don't forget, is a country without law. There's no rule of law in China. And I mean, in England, we've had the rule of law since the time of Henry II in the 14th century, and China has still yet to experience it. So it's got, and also it's, as Christopher Patton said, it's an affront to our civilized conscience, what goes on in China, because they don't allow Facebook or Google or anything like that, and it's just a total crackdown on any form of free thinking that might challenge the power of the Communist Party. And they're very happy that some people are making a lot of money. I mean, let's face it, most Chinese, especially those who live in the cities, have got a much higher standard of living now than they had, say, 20, 30 years ago. And then this makes them more happy to leave things as they, keep things as they are and not to object, because the Communist Party is basically buying the support of the public by raising their living standards. And the Communist Party now has nothing to do with Marx. It's not interested in Marx, but what it's only and it's not necessarily wedded to capitalism, but it is. It only sees capitalism as a means of keeping itself in power.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, also one thing that I've always found interesting is that much of their success has come with the aid of the West, the collusion with the West, if you will, industries, factories, and a lot of these things have moved there. And even another factor to this is even their poor environmentalism, right? A lot of companies can move to China because they can produce things, both products, but also in a way that would never be allowed in the West, right?
Exactly. And the terrible thing is that if you go and buy a washing machine now or something like that, they're all made in China. And I just read yesterday that a Chinese company had bought General Motors' entire white goods division. You know, that's fridges and washing machines and that sort of thing. And but we all contribute to this success of China when we buy from things that are made in China. And I always make a point of never buying anything made in China. I prefer to pay extra money and buy things that are made elsewhere, because I absolutely despise their system of government. And also, the more money they get, they've got this massive rearmament program going on at the moment, and it's totally unnecessary unless they're preparing for war. And especially the Navy. They're building up this huge, huge Navy. Now, why does China need a Navy? That's the good question. It's as I wrote in the book, it's a little bit like the Kaiser in the early 1900s when he started building that huge Navy to challenge England. Now, that was preparation for war, and it had no purpose other than a preparation for war, because Germany was and is a land nation, and it needed a very large army, which all European nations had at that time, France, Russia, Germany, and the Austrian Empire, because any one of them might have been attacked by the other. But Britain traditionally had a very, very small army, just more or less a patrolling force for any trouble that broke out in the empire, because being an island nation, it didn't need an army, and Britain concentrated on building up its huge navy. And the wonderful thing about the Royal Navy is that from the time of Trafalgar, I suppose, right through the 1800s until the First World War, the Royal Navy kept the oceans of the world free for all comers, you know, free freedom of navigation. And therefore, because Germany and all other countries had freedom of navigation on all the oceans of the world guaranteed by the Royal Navy, why did the Kaiser need a navy? And it was obviously just in preparation for war. Now, since 1945, as you know, the Royal Navy has not been able to be the policeman of the oceans, because Britain got such a battering in the Second World War. And that function has been taken over by the United States Navy.
Right.
And they have done a wonderful job of continuing this, guaranteeing the freedom of navigation of all of the oceans of the world, and especially the Pacific. And that's why, and China is challenging this by building these artificial islands in the South China Sea and making huge claims of all of the South China Sea and beyond. They've got something like four different lines. They call it a string of pearls, and they got 10-year periods when they want to be dominant in all of those, and that even gets right down to Samoa and Fiji and New Zealand. And whereas the United States, ever since 1945, has just guaranteed the freedom of the oceans. So why does China need this huge navy that it's building? And obviously, it doesn't need it to protect its own trade, because Chinese ships already have the freedom of the ocean to do that. And it's being built, obviously, for a very devious purpose, which will be presumably to make a strike at the West at a time of its own choosing, just as Japan did on the 7th of December 1941. So that when we buy these Chinese goods, we're consolidating their economy, enabling them to rearm for what will obviously almost certainly be a very bad purpose.
Interesting. Do we know what they're building more specifically? I have no idea if there's military, journals and intel that's trying to keep track of all of this.
Well, they've got a large number of nuclear submarines, and they've built caves in the cliffs on Hainan Island in the south of China, so that these subs can go under the water into these caves under the water and then emerge with land above, you know, in the cave, so that they can't be seen by Western satellites. And they've now got one aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, and they're building several more. Now, even Russia, which has shores on two oceans plus the Mediterranean Sea, has only one aircraft carrier. The Americans, of course, have about 12 or 13, thank God. But China is building a very large fleet of aircraft carriers now, starting to. And this is very disturbing, the Navy especially. And also the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, which was responsible for suppressing Tiananmen Square and any other outbreaks of dissent. They're about over 2 million strong, and they're the most secretive army in the world. And the Hawks, I suppose you'd call them the Hawks, the military faction, are now getting more and more authority inside Xi Jinping's government. And this is very disturbing. In the chapter, the second chapter of the book, China, A Threat to the Pacific, there are several quotations from these PLA generals who are now in a position of power in the government. And under that former leader, Deng Xiaoping, he said the military should be kept out of the government. And that is true. And it's interesting to compare this with Japan, because it was only after these military generals and admirals got control of the Japanese government that they launched their strike at Pearl Harbor. So this is very disturbing, and they've been making some very threatening noises. And that's why I think that the Americans have to be very alert to all this. And I have to say they have been doing their best, and the American Navy is the single great force for stability in the Pacific, and long may it remain so.
What do you think they're waiting for, China, I mean, in terms of, is there, obviously they're building up, this is a big portion of it as they're gaining in their economy, etc. They're still, of course, very much dependent on the American purchase power. They're actually buying debt even from America to keep the dollar floating, which is kind of interesting, right?
Look, I think I should point out that China's aim is to control the economic resources of the whole planet.
Right.
And they would prefer to be able to do that by peaceful means. Now, they're achieving that very nicely in Australia and New Zealand, thanks to our complacent and traitorous governments that are allowing them to. But the military is to be there as a form of intimidation to get its own way more easily. By moving into these countries. But at the last resort, if, for example, the United States and Canada and Australia said, right, no more, we're taking back all these things that you bought off us, but we'll pay you for them or whatever, then they've got the military. So the military sort of stands in the background as the ultimate force, but they hope that they won't have to use it. They hope to be able to achieve their object without military means.
Yes, exactly. So tell us a bit about what you think they have as a motivation. Obviously, you mentioned that the Communist Party, they seek simply to dominate and be in control. But
to stay in power, yes. They've got 80-something million members, and yet when they're so insecure that in one tiny fishing village in South China, they had a small democratic election to elect a village leader, and even with 80 million members, the Communist Party was so frightened of this one little fishing village called Wuhan, I think it was, that they arrested the village leader and his family and beat him up and that sort of thing. So yes, they've got problems, yeah.
Do you think they simply see their own people as pawns in this, or do they actually have any kind of sense of ethnic awareness that they do want to advance the objective of the Chinese people globally?
Oh, yes, they want to, and that's where they get a lot of support from the people. Because there is a chapter in the book, their superiority complex. And there's another book written by Martin Jakes, says When China Rules the World. And that's also a very interesting book. And these people in China, the Han Chinese, who constitute 92% of the population of China, they're very, very assertive, and they believe that they're top dogs, and they intend to be.
That's interesting, you know, because we don't hear much about that. But there is an element there of they want to try to basically, control, and they want to try to dominate. They want to try to basically enforce their vision of the world. What do you think
yes.
that we could expect if we let's assume that the United States position started to get weak, and now I don't think we're looking at that, considering that Trump has gotten in, so that the things have changed. But let's assume anyway that the trajectory that we used to be on, we're still holding true, and we had a declining United States with an increasing debt, etc. Maybe even militarily they would start to decline, and let's assume that China started to take over that role more or less. What do you think we would look at in that scenario?
Well, we can't drop the ball on this in any way, because once China get on, China want to be, there are two alternative viewpoints. Some say that China wants to be co-equal with the United States as a superpower, and they have sometimes put it to the American government that they carve the world up into spheres of influence, and the Americans won't have this on at any price because they don't want China as a co-superpower. There is the alternative view that China wants to be just the number one superpower, not a co-superpower to America, but above America. And both of these are very disturbing because of all the countries, I couldn't think of a worse superpower than China because it doesn't have a civil society in its own country. It's based on violence and force, the government is, and they treat their neighboring countries very badly. Look how they've taken those islands off the Philippines and off Vietnam, and they're stopping water going down the Mekong River to Thailand and Cambodia and Laos by their damming program. They've built something like more dams than all the rest of the world's ever built in history.
That's right.
And that's to dam these countries, dam the rivers of the waters of the Mekong, which is the lifeblood of Southeast Asia, and they can turn off the water at any time, and they just want countries to be around them to be tributaries, and that's very, very alarming.
Yeah, exactly. Very much so. So tell us a bit about how they're using immigration right now, because, you know, the doors of the West are standing wide open, and the liberal West thinks that we're helping these people and we're doing the best we can. What kind of, I know that obviously there's suppression in China, but I'm wondering what kind of scenario it is when many of these people, they flee from their own home, they go to Canada or the United States or New Zealand or Australia or other European countries, and then they still seem to kind of maintain a very, homogenous clique. They remain who they are as a colony inside of that country, pretty much. They speak their own language still. They don't really integrate. There might even be a faction here that sends money back to China, etc. So how are they using immigration, and how do you see that the West is being fools by allowing this to happen?
Of course, but I wouldn't quite agree with you when you say that they're fleeing from their country. I don't think that's quite correct, because the people who are coming to the West are more or less almost hand-picked by China to advance their interests in the West. And they're only letting the people out whom they know they can trust in the future. And they're not letting dissidents and people like that out, except in extreme cases. And that's the disturbing feature, that I find these Chinese people to be very, who are coming now from mainland China, to be very much what I would regard as fifth columnists in the event of trouble, just as the Japanese did the same thing in the 1930s, when a lot of Japanese went and settled in Singapore, Hong Kong, Hawaii, and places like that. And then when the moment came in at Pearl Harbor, they were all sending weather reports and everything back to Tokyo to help with the invasion. And they were doing things like that. And for example, in Australia last year, the leaders of a number of Chinese organizations in Australia, they urged their people there to support China's acquisition of these artificial islands of the Philippines, which is against the policy of the Australian government and against the wishes of the Australian people. And then in New Zealand last year, we had a referendum. This idiot Prime Minister John Key, who thank God has now resigned, he wanted to change our flag to get rid of the Union Jack from the upper corner.
That's right.
And he lost heavily. There was a referendum, and the people voted to keep the Union Jack because we're very proud of our British heritage and wanted to remain. And he went and had a secret lunch with five rich Chinese businessmen who gave him enough money to send brochures to 500,000 households in New Zealand, which is almost the whole country, urging them to vote to get rid of the Union Jack, because these five Chinese businessmen said they didn't like the Union Jack on our flag because that was on the Hong Kong flag, and they felt humiliated that Britain had taken Hong Kong from China in 1842. And so these are the types that are coming into the country. They're not loyal to the new country, and they're actually trying to undermine it. But I should make a point that There's a very big difference between Chinese people from Hong Kong or from Taiwan who come to the West and people from mainland China. And this is very important to think of this difference, because the people from Hong Kong and Taiwan are generally do fit in the West. They're much more so than others, and they generally have a better attitude. They've got better manners. But the people of mainland China, they're just all peasants, and they're not very well educated, and they are the pawns of the China government, and they are the problem, because when the Chinese communists took over China in 1949, all of the landed gentry, all the educated class, all people with any contacts to the West all fled to Taiwan, taking with them a lot of their artifacts and things like that, so that the museum in Taipei today has the finest collection of Chinese artifacts in the world. And China sometimes says it wants them back. Well, that would be foolish, because if they stayed in China, they would have been destroyed in the Cultural Revolution anyway. So yeah. The people of Taiwan have got very nice manners and things like that, because the better educated classes all fled to Taiwan. But a few engineers and doctors and people like that did stay on in China after 1949 on the grounds that they wanted to contribute to the new China that was being made. And all of those were wiped out in the Cultural Revolution. So that all you've got left in mainland China today is just peasants, hundreds of millions of peasants. And these businessmen that come fly around the world, they're just peasants in suits. Whereas the people of Hong Kong and the Chinese of Hong Kong, the Chinese of Taiwan, they're not like that at all. They've got far more manners and far more better standards.
Interesting. Maybe that's one of the reasons why they've been fighting to get Taiwan back or something. I mean, and remember that call that Trump did to the Taiwanese?
Yes.
I don't know if it was the prime minister or the president, but that was interesting, wasn't it?
Yes. No, they're very touchy about Taiwan. They want that back.
Yeah.
But I don't. I just hope that President Trump will be strong in the Pacific, and I think he will be. And as I say, I'm very heartened by the comments of Rex Tillerson at his confirmation hearings, because we need the American Navy in the Pacific very, very, very much.
Yeah, definitely. Now, just a side issue here, but do you know if China still has their one-child policy in place?
They've recently amended it. I think you can have two now.
Huh.
Yeah, it's recently been amended.
Yeah, because the population has grown so intensely. I mean, it's just it's amazing how many they are. And you said they had an army of about 2 million standing, right?
Yes.
Largest army in the world, I believe.
I believe so, yes, and very secretive.
Let's talk a bit about the China-New Zealand Free Trade Agreement. Recently, of course, we'd had, thank God, President Trump putting an end to TPP, which was...
That was wonderful.
Wonderful, absolutely brilliant. But what is this specifically, the New Zealand-China Free Trade Agreement?
Well, it must have been about 2007, I think. The Labor government of New Zealand became the first Western country to have a free trade agreement with China. Now, the word free trade agreement is completely misleading. It should have been called a colonizing agreement, because how can you have a free trade agreement between a small country of 4 million people and a country of 1.2 billion people without the larger country dominating? And that's exactly what's happened. And China has just used this free trade agreement to grab our resources and to control and dominate our economy. And the Labor trade minister who negotiated this free trade agreement, he wouldn't give any details, all very secretive. His name is Phil Goff, a ghastly opportunist, always looking out for the main chance for himself. Now, as a reward for ceding this sovereignty of New Zealand to China by way of the free trade agreement. He stood for the mayor of Auckland last year, and he the Chinese gave him $250,000 for his campaign, which was almost all his campaign funds. And of that, $100,000 came directly from communist China, and the rest was given by wealthy Chinese businessmen in Auckland. So if that's not a compromised mayor, I don't know what is. But that's the type of rubbish, or if you like, scum that the New Zealanders are prepared to elect.
Freedom.
Now, the free, Well, I think you don't get much closer, I don't think. Now, he's a terrible man, but he's only one of many. Now, there's also the free trade agreement. Part of it was that we have to let in 1,800 Chinese every year into our country. There are
really?
Many more that come. Many more that come, of course. But this is written into the agreement. Now, these are to be Confucius teachers and all these other things. And that means that we've lost control over our immigration policy. Because let's say, for example, at some point in the future, we need to cut down immigration severely. Well, we can't in respect of what we've agreed to accept from China. So why does our government just give away these rights? And now they're doing an upgrade of the free trade agreement. Well, New Zealand's got nothing more to offer, but China has got all these extra demands, including wanting to make a closer defense arrangement with New Zealand. And yet China is the only country that can be described as our potential enemy. And yet our treasonous government is going ahead with this.
So are your leaders just stupid, or are they bought and
paid
for?
Well, they get paid. They get when they retire from politics, the Chinese government will look after them. For example, let me give you an example. We had this so-called national prime minister. When I say national calls itself centre-right, but there's no difference between national and Labour. There are just two ways of saying the same thing. Now, this woman, there was an APEC conference in Christchurch, New Zealand, when she was prime minister, and there was a small group of pro-Tibet demonstrators who wanted to demonstrate against the former Chinese leader, Jiang Zemin, and he refused to go to his own dinner at this hotel until these people were silenced. So through her prime minister's department, this prime minister didn't want any trouble, so she got the police to suppress them by putting big buses across from them and drowning out their sounds and this sort of thing, and then that was enough to appease the Chinese leader to turn up to his dinner. Now, this was a huge favor that she gave to China, because he didn't have to suffer a loss of face. So when she retired, she's now on $90,000 a year as chairman of a Chinese bank in New Zealand. She's on every other, many other Chinese companies, all owned by the government of China, have all rewarded her. And we've just had this other one, Prime Minister John Key, resign last year, and I'm just waiting to see if he also accepts a lot of benefits from China in the form of directorships of New Zealand subsidiaries of companies owned by communist China.
Interesting.
So basically, all our leaders down here can be bought. They're quite easily. And the amazing, what the Chinese are so surprised about is how cheap it is.
Exactly.
I mean, they only have to pay
a
few thousand. They pay 80,000, or and then another 20,000, things like that. And they've bought the National Party, which is the governing party here. And in Vanuatu, which used to be the New Hebrides in the Pacific, a small Pacific nation, they bought the government by refitting free of charge the Prime Minister's office. Oh, he's got the most expensive-looking office in the Pacific. And they got the Cook Islands government on side by giving a quad bike to every MP in the Cook Islands. This is what they're doing, and they cannot believe how cheap it is that they can buy these politicians. So the main problem is in the West. It's the types of people we vote for. That's the problem. And it's not just on the China issue. It's on other issues. It's on many other issues too. And most too many Western countries have got cowardly, appeasing, unprincipled governments who will give in to the bullying of any strong force, no matter how hostile that force might be.
So what's so amazing to me is that we're dealing with countries that are have budgets in the trillions of dollars and euros and everything else, and then our leaders, all it takes for them is just to get a couple of thousands here and there, and they're bought and paid for. Clearly something is flawed, I guess, within our system for us to appoint these people that are willing to take bribes and sell out their own people, right?
It's not all of them that settle for such small amounts. Have you seen how much Tony Blair has made since he ceased to be Prime Minister?
Oh, it's astronomical. It's ridiculous.
It's 85 million pounds, apparently.
Yeah.
And don't forget that when he went into Parliament, he was about a 22-year-old a junior barrister with no business experience of any kind. So how could he possibly make 85 million pounds in only a few short years with no business experience unless he was doing things that, let's say, he shouldn't have been doing?
I think he's getting paid for doing what his masters told him to do, which was to destroy the United Kingdom, pretty much. There was a book that came out afterwards that talked about how he intentionally was trying to destroy the ethnic homogenous makeup of Britain with immigration.
Oh, yes. No, you're absolutely right. But I'm afraid that under the Conservatives, things haven't changed very much.
No, it hasn't. Now, you have a number of chapters in your book where you go through in detail different sectors, if you will, where the Chinese are taking over. From losing our farms to the vineyards to forests, even to things like electricity and things like this.
Yes.
Tell us about this a bit more, about how they're taking over various aspects of New Zealand, the infrastructure and the resources.
Well, one of the most alarming is the Wellington Electricity Network, which they bought for about $800 million. I don't know how they were ever allowed to. So they've now got control of our electricity network. And in the event of trouble, by which I mean war, they could easily just turn the electricity off to the capital city of the country.
Amazing.
I know. But this is our government for you. I mean, no self-respecting government would allow such important infrastructure to fall into the hands of a potentially hostile power. And the man who owns it is this Li Ka-shing, and he's being chased in Australia for almost $1 billion in tax that he's dodged. And yet in New Zealand, they haven't even done a tax investigation on his business interests here. And he owns several vineyards and everything. And he's just, although he's Asia's richest man, we know how he became rich. He's just a crummy little tax dodger. And this is the types of people that our government gets into bed with.
Are you one of the only ones that are speaking out about this? I'm wondering, why is there no one even within the political system that's like warning about this? It's amazing.
Well, there is one party in New Zealand called New Zealand First, which is similar maybe to One Nation in Australia and to Marine Le Pen's party in France and to the AFD in Germany, because they are very concerned about putting the interests of the nation of New Zealanders first. And that's why it's called New Zealand First. And the leader of that, Mr. Winston Peters, who incidentally was named after Winston Churchill, he does speak out very strongly against the intrusion of China into our society. He called Jenny Shipley, the woman I told you about, the prime minister who takes all the money from China, he's called her economic treachery, and he's warned New Zealand that China has a dangerous hold over us and things like that. But his is a minority party, and the media here, of course, they just laugh at him and say that he's some xenophobic and all that sort of thing. So there is his party that speaks out about it. But apart from that, I should tell you that New Zealanders are not known to be they're very intellectually lazy people. And most New Zealanders take all their opinions from what they see on the 6 o'clock news or in the Sunday papers.
Unfortunately, they do, yeah, like the majority of people in the West. What else do you think?
No, it's worse. It's worse. It's worse in New Zealand.
I've
spent a lot of time in many countries, and I've never seen such apathetic and gullible people as we have in this country.
It's funny. I said the same about Sweden, but
No. I've met a lot of Swedes, and they're far more switched on than New Zealanders are.
All right. Well, I don't know about that, but
but you're right. You're right. They are quite indoctrinated too. I have also found that.
Yeah.
I think that's from your school system over there, I think.
Oh, definitely. What else should we know about Jenny Shipley that we haven't talked about so far, do you think?
Well, I mean, she's a bit like Blair. She had no business experience of any kind. She was a school teacher before she went into Parliament. And therefore, what would she know about business? And then the Chinese put her on to another company that they had. This was not a Chinese government-owned company. It was a private company called Mainzeal, which had been a very successful construction company in New Zealand. And it was bought by a Chinese man, and he put her on it because she gets put on the boards of just about every company with a Chinese connection. And she presided over its downfall. I think it lost $450 million, went bankrupt, and all the subcontractors who had lost their money for work done. And that's the type of disaster she is. She just doesn't know, it appears that she doesn't know anything about business. And therefore, what the Chinese want is somebody who's got access to ministers, because they think that trumps business experience. Almost any member of our National Party can look forward to a nice job on a Chinese board after they retire, because they still have access to their former colleagues in the government, you see.
I wonder if there's any way that we could find I doubt that there would be contracts written about this kind of stuff, but obviously some kind of meeting must be going on where the Chinese government approaches these people and proposes some of these things to them, right?
Oh, yes, and they're very willing. Our people, they're very willing to take anything.
Exactly. Yeah, they are. It's unbelievable.
Yes, but you're right. It's a malaise that's right across the West. And what should happen is people should not vote for these parties that sell out their country to foreign interests. And that's going on all over the place. And that's why I'm very hopeful that Marine Le Pen in France will be able to win this presidential election, because it would be such a game changer for the world. Because I read yesterday a very interesting article from the London Daily Telegraph, and they explain that she's got certain demands on the EU, including getting out of the Eurozone, and it would be more or less the end of the Eurozone, end of the European Union, if France should get out, because that would be Holland would definitely follow, because they would not want to be on the side of the Germans as against France and England. And no doubt Denmark would also get out. So I think there's some very interesting things going on at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. She's 5 points ahead currently in the polls, and, of course, the situation that's unfolded in Paris.
I don't think she's 5 points. Is she 5 points ahead?
Thing I read, but, again, polls, so you got to take it with a grain of salt.
Of course. President Trump showed that, didn't he?
Yeah, well, exactly, certainly. I hope she's more ahead of that. I actually read that there was an AI, artificial intelligence, that was predicting just here the other day that Le Pen would win the election, so I hope it's correct.
Yes, I do too, because I think that the age of these colonizing, sovereignty-sapping free trade agreements is over. It should be over anyway, because they take away too much sovereignty from each individual nation. And without sovereignty, you can't have meaningful democracy, because what is the point of electing, say, a new government in a country if when they get into power they find they can't do this, they can't do that, they can't do the other thing because of all these damned trade agreements?
Yeah, absolutely. You have a chapter on one specific company in the book, Huawei, if I pronounce that correctly.
Huawei, I think it's called. Yeah. The telecommunications company. Now, they seem to be a very dodgy company all around the world.
They're in multiple countries, of course.
Yes. And they're very closely connected to the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, and to the Chinese government.
So people are buying phones and tablets where who knows if there's backdoors and surveillance and things?
In New Zealand, it's hard to buy one that's not Huawei, although the Swedish Ericsson, the Swedish one, is an alternative.
Yeah, they've done some. They're not that prominent anymore, of course, in the mobile market, unfortunately. But, one thing I want to do here before we take a short break here between the segments, we have much more to discuss. There's many more chapters in the book that we haven't talked about yet, but I'd just like to make sure that you let know our listeners how they can get a copy of the book, if there's a specific website, or if they should go to the publisher or Amazon, or where do you recommend people to go?
Well, they can, I think maybe they go to our website. It's www.trosspublishing.co.nz. That is our website, or there can be an email, trosspub, trosspub, @gmail.com. We have stocks in England also of the book.
And we'll make sure to have a link up, of course, to the website. And where was there, just I asked that in the beginning and we didn't clarify that. Was there another version of the book that's geared towards the Australian audience, or was there another?
No, not at this stage. But what I'm thinking of doing is maybe writing another book which would keep the basic chapters of China's military threat and the oppression that goes on in China and its aims for the world. But I would take out the New Zealand chapters and I would put in chapters that cover all the countries of the world. And then that could be sold internationally so that it's not so New Zealand-centered.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I think more people need to know about this. They need to be warned about this.
Yes, because it's China's doing this all over the world, even in Europe. I mean, they've just bought that nuclear power company in Britain, which I think was Theresa May's first mistake that she's made, was to allow them to do so.
Ron, let's continue to talk more about this here after a short break. We're going to continue with Ron Asher and talk more about the book In the Jaws of the dragon.
In the Jaws of the Dragon, How China is Taking Over New Zealand, yes.
Very good. Thank you so much. Okay, well, stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, Ron. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more.